However, for some of you might think it's an ironing board. What's the difference? How could someone prove to me this is a desk?
When you use it as a desk.
Go on.
When you use it as a desk.
Use it as a desk? I could use it as an ironing board too, couldn't I?
When you call it a desk.
The what?
When you call it a desk.
When I call it a desk. Yeah. Right. This is the point I'm making, and this is where we're going to look at faith. Because really, faith is only a small part of Buddhist understanding. It's kind of, I guess you could use another word, is trust. And at some point we actually do have to have trust, because we look at this and we go, we call it a desk, looks like a desk, but someone thinks it's an ironing board, and it has all the qualities of an ironing board, doesn't it? It's flat, you can iron on it. It's a desk, I can write on it. Where in fact, and we're going to be talking about this tonight, we're actually going to go on to a little bit of Touching the Heart Sutra tonight. It depends on our view. And firstly, I'm going to talk about the Four Noble Truths in relationship to trust. So when the Buddha became enlightened, he had a bit of a problem. How am I going to teach people the information they need to help themselves and have faith that what I'm teaching them is correct? Now, could you imagine all of a sudden your mind becomes omniscient? You can see every atom in the universe. You know every past, present and future thought of every being in every universe all at the one moment. And you've got someone in front of you who's a farmer, and you're going to say, well, I've got a lot to show you. What am I going to do? And the brilliance of the Buddha was that he explained the first noble truth, which was there is suffering, there is dissatisfaction. That was a truth that someone could get. Anyone that lives on this planet or experiences or can articulate their experience will say, yes, we have dissatisfaction. Sometimes we have a headache, sometimes we don't get what we want, sometimes we get what we don't want, and that is an absolute real truth. It's a real truth for all of us. Whichever way we label it, there is stuff that we don't like and there is stuff that we do like, and we always want more of what we do like and we want less of what we don't like. So when he said there is suffering, that was exactly the way to get through to human beings to understand a reality. From our own point of view, we can look at it and we can say, yeah, that's actually true. I once met a guy once who, he was talking about Buddhism, and he said, oh, you guys talk about suffering. And I said, well, everyone suffers. He said, I don't. Which was a complete fallacy, because I knew the guy's life and he had some terrible things happen to him. He said, oh, no, I don't suffer. No, I'm happy all the time, which was really not true. We always have to accept that we have things we don't like. In any one particular moment in your life, is everything perfect? Anyone? Anybody? I mean everything perfect. Your body's comfortable, you have enough money, everything's going perfectly. It just doesn't happen, does it? We call that samsara, the place of dissatisfaction. However, that was a reality, and then the Buddha said, well, there's a way out of that. We've just moved into faith. There's a way out of this. Well, how do I know? He says, there's a way out of it. How do I know? And he says, well, I've done it. I've actually cracked it. I've found the way out of this. There is a path to tread out of this, and there's an end to it. Well, how do I know? So in a sense, with Buddhist faith, you have to almost approach it like that. If I said to you, okay, well, we have a belief in karma as Buddhists, or I suppose not everyone here is a Buddhist, but maybe not, doesn't matter. But generally Buddhists have a belief in karma. which is cause and effect. How do we know that happens from life to life? And how do we know we've got previous lives? If I haven't experienced it, or I don't understand it, or I can't see it, then it's not real for me. So we have to have some kind of faith that these things are correct. And the way that happens is, in a sense, we build on our experience. Blind faith is what? What do you reckon blind faith is? Yeah, it's without actually any substantial proof on any level for ourselves, and I'm not talking about others, where we just go, oh yeah, well that's going to happen. Gamblers have blind faith. They believe that when they're on a winning streak, you bet more because it's going to continue. That's blind faith. There is no empirical knowledge, no algorithm that's going to prove that if you win once, you're going to win the next hand of cards or whatever. And yet, people spend a fortune on gambling because they believe that sometimes they're going to win. When in fact, as one casino owner of Las Vegas was standing in front of his casino in a documentary, and he said, guess what? This whole town's built on losers. He said, I make my fortune on losers. And he's saying it, you know, quite openly. Come into my casino, you're going to lose your money. And you have faith that maybe I'll just crack it this time. So we often do this kind of thing, this projection, based on no real reality at all. So when we have to have faith in Buddhism, we have to develop a sound basis of our experience. And that then develops a very strong faith that we're on the right track. Now, it can be you can meet spiritual teachers, gurus, practitioners who you have a particular rapport with, or you really believe what they say, or you even have an experience of their presence. And you get a sense of peace and calmness about these people. And when they talk stuff that resonates with us. It doesn't matter whether it resonates with anyone else. That's unimportant. But it resonates with us. In my experience with my teacher over a 35-year period, I never saw him give an answer that wasn't either impressive or definitely right. Even when, if you asked him a question, the answer was kind of bizarre, or he would direct you to do something and you'd think, that's a bit weird. And when you carried out the action, the things changed and they worked out for themselves. So that's where I developed my faith in the beginning. Was with a teacher. But initially, I had some doubts. And I'll tell you my experience of developing faith. I went to a Buddhist course at Chen Rising Institute in 1978. A long, long while ago. Ancient history for you guys. I'm 150. 1978, and I went into this course, and I'd read a bit about Buddhism, and there were two Tibetan lamas teaching me, and we went through this. It was really interesting. We went through this course, and they would give things like, well, you know, the Buddha's wisdom is like the sun, you know, it shines on everything, and they were giving these kind of examples. But there was one guy in the course who kept saying, well, you can't say that. That's just using one metaphor to say something else works. So, that doesn't make sense. So he was really what you would call white-anting the whole process. So it was really interesting because we were confronted with the teachings of the Buddha and this other guy going, that's just, how do you know that happens? How do you know you've had a past life? How do you know this stuff? And so it was this wonderful kind of balance. And yet sitting in the presence of these lamas, one was a translator and one was the teacher, which turned out to be my teacher, there was a sense of presence and a sense of, how should I put it? There was a sense of truth there, even though nothing was provable. There was this kind of interesting mix. There's the guy going, nah, 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 nah. And that went on for 2 weeks until the final lesson, which was fantastic. Because what I found out, and this is my words, is that nothing is necessarily provable. I can't prove this is a desk. I can't prove this is a cup. If you think that's an orange, I've got a problem. You know? Oh, yeah, but an orange is sweet. Oh, yeah, well, I drank that. That's quite sweet. Okay, where do I go with that? But one thing I did find out, which gave me unshakable faith, is that I can prove that something doesn't exist. It's called a non-affirming negative. And it's the view of emptiness, which is in the Heart Sutra, Shunyata. So I can't prove to you that that's a cup. I can't prove it to you. Oh, a cup's round, so is a ball. It holds things, so does a bowl. So whatever terminology I can use is difficult. So I can't prove that's a cup if you don't believe it. However, I can prove to you that it's not a cup. How? This is where we move into the view of emptiness, that things are empty of inherent existence. I cannot find, if I dissect that piece by piece, take the handle off, undo the cup, get an electron microscope, and look at the atoms and the positrons and the quarks, and I don't know how far down you go, but you keep looking, I can't find one atom or molecule or anything that is the cup. Not one of them. And yet, that are cup. And the way my teacher started this talk, so there's the guy who through the whole course is going, nah, you can't, don't have to believe that. How do they know that? How can you prove that? Yeah, they say the Buddha's enlightened. How do you know the Buddha's enlightened? What's enlightenment? You know? And the Lama sat there and he held up a flower and he pulled off a petal and he said, is that the flower or is that the flower? Is that the flower or is that the flower? And he completely dissected the flower. He said, where is the flower? Where is it? And yet, he said, you were looking at a flower. Where is it? Where's the flower? And I'm sitting there going, this is starting to stir up my mind a bit. I'm not sure where this is going. And then he said, okay, and my teacher's name was Geshe Loden. He said, okay, Geshe Loden pulls off his arm. Is the arm Geshe Loden or is Geshe Loden here? He pretended to dissect his whole body. And he goes, where is Geshe Loden? And I'm going, hold it. He's there a minute ago. Now he's dissected. Which bit's Geshe Loden? And so this went on for a whole hour until I walked out of there, my head completely messed up. So I went down to the kitchen and I'm sitting in the kitchen. There's a monk sitting there. So I turned to him and I said, so nothing exists. He said, if I slap you, will it hurt? Oh, no. What am I going to do with that? And so all of a sudden, I realised there was an understanding there. Now, the poor guy had gone through the whole course with his superior knowledge of, it's just allegories. He said, there's no real, you know. He's sitting there like someone had hit him with a cricket bat. He could hardly speak. I said, what's wrong? He went, I don't know. I said, but I'm not sure. And he was like that for the next day. He couldn't speak because the reality of it was that was a true, actual reality. That there is nothing that is findable. And yet, it all exists. It exists as a dependent reality and a label. So I can label it. Once I label it, I give it a inherent form that actually doesn't exist. I call it a cup. I see it as a cup. It has cupness. But when I look for where the cupness is, it's not the handle, it's not the lip, it's not the bottom. and yet I call it a cup. And that, for me, was the beginning of my real faith in Buddhism. That here was an answer to the reality, absolutely reality of the universe, of everything, the way everything existed. And I never found it anywhere else. And I'd looked for 22 years. I'd studied martial arts from the age of 14, three or four different disciplines. I'd looked at all the different religions of the world. But none of them had told me the way things function, the reality of things. Nothing. None. I couldn't find it anywhere. And so for me, that was the beginning of my experience. And then I went, well, if they can tell me how everything functions in the universe, then they've really got something I'm going to have some faith in. No, I don't see my past lives. I trust that they're there. I have faith that that's the cause. Because when someone can tell me the ultimate nature of the way things function in the universe, I figure they've got a lot more answers about other things that I haven't seen yet. There's a wonderful story in a book called Blazing Splendor, written by a very famous lama called Tukul Ogen. And it's a very unusual book. You can get it on Amazon, Blazing Splendor. And he goes around the different lamas and he asks about their experiences. Now, typically, great masters don't tell you about their experiences because it looks like ego grasping or it can create some difficulties. But he was able to, because he was a great master, he was able to get some words out of some of these masters. And towards the end of the book, he asked one Tibetan Lama, he said, what are your realizations? And he goes, oh, yeah, all right, well, I'll tell you. I shouldn't, but I'll tell you. He said, I'm not like the great masters. He said, I only remember my last 500 lives and my next 500. Which was just, when I read that, I went, oh, my God, that's extraordinary. He goes, oh, I'm not a great master. I can only remember my past 500 lives. And my own teacher said that when you achieve single point of concentration, or samadhi or calm abiding, you can remember your past lives like what you've had for breakfast. So through being with these great masters and just also sitting in their presence and feeling the energy of their mind, the calmness of their mind, I developed more and more faith. So very quickly, from 1978, I became a Buddhist because they had answers there that I'd been looking for a long while. I remember at 9 years of age, standing in the backyard of my parents' home, looking at the sky going, what is the answer to this? There's got to be one answer. And that one answer was dependent arising and emptiness. And it took me from the age of 9 till 22 until I actually found the reality of that. And so that's where my faith developed. I'm going to read a little bit tonight, because being a lengthy subject, I thought I might do a few more quotes rather than just talk at you. Faith is only an initial trust in the Buddha as a spiritual teacher and an initial acceptance of the Buddha's teachings. So it's not the whole thing. You can't build your Buddhist practice just on faith. By listening to the teachings and putting them into practice, that is the real essence of the Buddha's teaching. And the Buddha said very directly, don't just have faith in me and believe it because of me. He said, take this information, take these teachings and try it out. Find out whether it works for you. Find out whether being angry with someone gets them to listen to you and change their behaviour. Has anyone ever been really angry at someone trying to get a point across and you realise in the middle of your anger they just completely shut down? Because that's what happens. When you're screaming at someone, they're going, screaming, not logic, not wisdom. What we're after actually is assertiveness. If we're assertive, which is actually in the dictionary, the word assertive means stating the truth, then we have an effect on people. If we're yelling at them through our anger, which is, in Buddhist terms, the desire to harm, then nothing happens. It usually goes pear-shaped, we might have lost a friend, certainly things don't go well. So in Buddhism they say anger is not your friend. It's one of the worst delusions. So we can test that out, you know. See how your anger gets things done. It doesn't. I'm not talking about when you tell a little kid in a very loud voice not to put their hand in the fire. That's not anger. That's wrathfulness, and it's coming from compassion. And in fact, I've had my teacher yell at me. But I knew when he was yelling at me, it wasn't because he wanted me to be harmed. He was yelling at me because I was an idiot and I needed to wake up. And that was a different experience, because I realized it was coming from compassion and love. So I had great faith. And you'll notice anyone that has a teacher who has great faith in their teacher, they will be prepared to be disciplined so that their minds actually improve. And then you see the results of that. So when you start to practice the different concepts of Buddhism, the Buddha taught for over 40 years on this planet and said that he taught 84,000 dharmas to combat the 84,000 delusions that we have. We've got a lot. But when you start to put it into practice, you start to notice things happen. Now, I work with a lot of business people, not Buddhists, and I teach them meditation, and a lot of executives. And there's one particular executive I've worked with for a while, and she said to me that just the practice of meditation changes her perspective at work. When she goes to work, she's meditated in the morning. She told me when I first started with her that she could not meditate for more than 5 minutes. I said, I love a challenge. And now she meditates for 3/4 of an hour, quite comfortably. Sits. Because if you can do one breath in and one breath out, you can do another one. And then you do another one. And all of a sudden you've done one each time for 3/4 of an hour. And so what she's experienced, just through the practice of meditation, mindfulness of the breath, which is originally a Buddhist practice, but just doing that has actually changed her experience at work. Just changed her experience at work. Just doing that. Another girl I worked with, again, Buddhist technology. She was a fashion editor from a big magazine. And she had a real stress problem. And she was drinking a lot of alcohol to deal with stress. She said she was going out every second night and actually getting plastered with alcohol because the stress was so much. It was the only way she could stop thinking and worrying. And she said, I'm in a real mess, what am I going to do? And I said, well, here you go, bit of Buddhist technology. You're going to stop drinking for 2 weeks and you're going to do half an hour meditation every day. And she looked at me in horror, and I said, well, you come to me, that's what you're going to get. Simple solution, no drinking, half an hour of meditation every day. I don't want to hear from you or talk to you for 2 weeks. Come back and see me later. Bit tough. She came back 2 weeks later and she went, oh, wow, that so worked for me. That was amazing. I said, what happened? She said, well, one of the things that was happening as a fashion editor is her creativity was drying up. And she said, I couldn't think of anything. You know, we had fashion shoots and my mind was just like a blob. She said, it was really worrying me that my creativity had dried up. And she said, the moment I start meditating, I get all these amazing ideas. She said, it's just coming up. So I said, what did you do? She said, oh, I started writing them down. I said, yes. And she said, and then I kind of worked, a smart girl, I kind of worked out that wasn't meditating. I went, yep, that's right. So she said, then what I did, she said, I just got back to meditation, because that's what she told me to do. And she said, at the end of the meditation session, there were all these ideas just sitting there. So I just pulled my mind off them. I didn't push them away, I just left them where they were. And she said, they were. She said, it's changed my whole job. It's changed everything the way I look at things. Just half an hour a day for 2 weeks. Amazing. And so then when she got a job with a huge English magazine, they heard about this fabulous fashion editor in Australia and they grabbed her. When she was leaving Australia, she wrote me a little card. She said, thank you for giving me back my mind. Now, I didn't do anything. I just gave her practice. But that practice came straight out of my Buddhist practice. Straight out of it. So again, I saw this stuff working on people that weren't involved in faith. Obviously, they had some faith to come to me and take the painful journey of half an hour a day. But it worked for her. And again, that set her on a spiritual path. She went to England, she got involved in yoga, meditation, the whole thing. Her life changed dramatically from that situation where she could have really become an alcoholic or lost a job or whatever. Who knows where it would have gone. So when I saw those kinds of things on a practical level, that's when my faith started to develop. And that's what I'm saying about faith in Buddhism. It has to be based on some experiential knowledge. So you have to go out and test it. Test it, test it, test it. I'll keep going. Faith as understood in the sutra is the teachings of the Buddha and in the Buddha's own eternality. In other words, the continuation of the Buddhist consciousness. More specifically, it is belief in such doctrines as the law of karma, in the reality and the eternity of the three jewels and the path. Now, the law of karma, hard to prove, but we have some understanding on a direct, this is why I was talking about anger, on a direct relationship. If we cause someone pain directly and purposefully, we know in our hearts that something's gone wrong. We have this sense. We all have this inner sense about right and wrong on some level. Sometimes that can get trained out of us and do other things. But in a sense, what we're doing is that when we create a rift with someone and we do it knowingly or through anger or lack of control, we know that's fractured the situation. And so we can go and look back at the teachings of the Buddha and it says, yeah, as I said earlier, anger is one of the worst delusions. And so in the end, if your mind is clear and peaceful, it means that you are not creating tensions in your life. If you tell a lie to someone purposely, it causes a difficulty. There was a situation, a girl came to me once and told me that she had gone to a shop and she had bought something. And the person had accidentally put two of those items in the bag. And when she got home, she found the two items and she came to me as a Buddhist teacher and said, I don't know what to do about it. I said, well, how long ago did it happen? She said, oh, about 2 or 3 weeks. I said, well, it's pretty obvious. You go back to the shop, you either hand the second thing back or you pay for it. She said, oh, no, I'd be too embarrassed. I went, uh-huh. So what are you carrying around? She said, oh, a lot of guilt. I said, well, there's the solution. You either carry around this huge sack of guilt or you go and fix it up. Go back to the shop. So I'm really sorry. Gave this by mistake. I should have come back earlier. Here's the money for it. Well, here it is back again. She said, oh, I'm going to find that too hard. So there was a situation of just being open and honest about a situation that she didn't create, but she had compounded into a real problem for herself. It's like apologies. Apologies, I love this quote from someone that said, an apology puts out a fire. When you've been wrong, you say, look, I'm really sorry. Again, Buddhist teachings, being absolutely honest with people. And here's another story. This is a friend of mine in Melbourne. He got a job, he's an accountant, he got a job in a big company. And when he got the job, my teacher said to him, if you make the slightest mistake, you go to your boss and tell him you've made a mistake. And he went, do I have to? No, just the slightest mistake. You go into his office and say, look, I'm really sorry, I made this mistake. And he went, oh, that's going to be really painful. My ego will be bruised. I'll feel that I'm not good enough. And, you know, so he went through all the stuff in his head, but because this was his teacher telling him to do it, he did it. And so every time He didn't make that many mistakes, but whenever he made the smallest mistake, he'd go right into the boss's office. 6 months later, 25 people got retrenched and he got a promotion. There you go. So he thought that he was showing his boss that he was a real dummy by making mistakes. What the boss saw was someone that he could trust implicitly to carry out the job perfectly. So that was the wisdom of the teacher. And so obviously he had great faith in the teacher even more after that. At first it was painful, it was difficult. And so this faith develops from putting things into practice. I'm going to read a bit more. Buddha points out that people's beliefs may turn out in two different ways. They might be genuine, factual, unmistaken, or vain, empty, and false. Thus, when a person holds a certain belief, they should not derive the conclusion, only this is true, anything else is false, but instead preserve the truth by commenting on the belief with, this is my belief. This is why Buddhists don't stand on street corners telling people they have to become Buddhists. Because we have to accept our experience is where we're coming from. This is our experience. In fact, every single one of you has their own Buddhism. There's obviously similar beliefs and similar acceptances, but you all carry it out individually because you are all individuals. One guy I know became a Buddhist through looking at the back of one book. This guy was a construction worker on the Snowy Mountains scheme in the 60s. Never looked at Buddhism, never grew up with any religious faith whatsoever. None at all. But he'd had a difficult life. He'd had a couple of marriages broken down. He'd had, a difficult life. His parents had died young, so there was a lot of stuff in his life that was really unpleasant. And he was walking past a bookshop and he said he never read books much, wasn't really interested in them, he watched television instead, but he just took a detour and walked inside this bookshop. And he picked up a book by a guy called David Mickey, and it was called Buddhism for Busy People. Has anyone come across it? It's a great little book. Actually, I know the author. Yeah, it's good, isn't it?
Yeah.
Buddhism for Busy People. So he picks it up and he reads the back cover. On the back cover, it said something like, if you've picked up this book, it's no coincidence. What? Whoop. What am I going to do with that? And then it talks about karma. You have picked up this book due to your previous karma and your connection with the teaching. Something like that. I can't remember the back cover. But he said that was it. And he went, oh. And then he thought for a moment. And it said everything's due to karma. And then he thought, hold it. This is a realization he had right from just the back of the book. And he went, what's the common denominator against all the difficulties I've had in my life? What's the one common factor? Me. Himself. And he went, oh my goodness. So he immediately had this belief in karma. He kind of got the idea that everything that happens around you, you're in the centre. If you're experiencing it, it's something to do with what you have created or the fact that you're even there. And so when he walked into the bookshop and it said, you're not here by coincidence, that this is a karmic result, he actually got it. And the guy became a Buddhist just from that. Because it resonated with him. And his main focus is on karma. And when he's had even more difficulties in his life, he's had some illnesses and things, he still goes back to, I created this somewhere in the past. Therefore, I'm experiencing exactly what my mind stream is carrying in terms of karma. It's not a blame, it's an experience. So what I can say to you all, it's all your fault. How's that? It's all your fault. And that's the good news. Because if it's someone else's fault, you're in deep trouble. And why is that? Because if it's all our fault, then we can change it. If we're creating this bow wave of karma, then that's the good news. And that to me is wonderful. The fact that it is my fault. I could have done a bit better, but you know, there's always hope that I will achieve better results as I go along. And Buddhism really is about that. It's so simple. Find out what creates a good result, do that. Find out what creates a bad result and don't do that. That's it. It's the whole of Buddhist action and faith. And so we go back to the teachings of the Buddha and we start to realise that if we really start to dissect each of them, it comes up with a truth that can really resonate for us, but in our own particular way. As I said, each and every one of us has our own Buddhism. There's no two Buddhisms alike. They have a general theme, but it's the way we carry them out. Your guru might say to you, okay, I don't want you to open up this clinic for the poor. I want you to go into the mountains and meditate. And a lot of people would go, oh my goodness. You mean, here was I going to be in service for poor people and yet I'm going to sit in a cave meditating. But if the teacher's really clear, knows that that action will create more good in the future, that's where you have to have faith. That's the difficult part. When your teacher asks you to do something that you find difficult or against your knowledge. However, that's why in Buddhism, particularly in the Tibetan tradition, you're told to spend about 10 years checking up on your guru before you accept them. 10 years of checking. It's a long while. Now you may meet a teacher and you check and check and check and check and check. And then finally, there comes a point where you maybe reject, no big deal, or you totally accept that person as a teacher. And teachers can also be books as well. We can get inspiration from books. It doesn't necessarily have to be a physical teacher. It helps because it's a bit like getting training on any level. If someone's there to watch you and slap you into line, it's much easier than you trying to work it out. So if you're lucky enough to have a direct teacher, that's great, great, great situation. But that doesn't mean you can't practice Buddhism without a guru. And so the development of that develops your faith, develops your trust. And so again, when to develop faith in Buddhism, we have to look around us and see what other Buddhist practitioners are doing. Are they acting in accord with the way we think people should act, or are they out of sync, or are they doing stuff that we don't believe in? And if we find the community seems to be in a resonance with where we understand or approve, then that's also a strengthening of our faith in the direction. As I said, we can't know that karma exists truly from lifetime to lifetime unless we experience. However, we do have some understanding of karma in the fact of cause and effect, in that we put our key in the car ignition and we turn it on and it starts. We don't have randomness where we put the key in and turn it over and it turns into an apple tree. That would be confusing. That's called randomness. We've only got three possibilities: randomness, cause and effect, and randomness and cause and effect. So let's have a look at randomness. Randomness is the situation of nothing is in our control whatsoever. You plant an apple seed and it turns into a melon bush or something. Everything's completely chaotic. So that's randomness. My brother asked me once, I was talking to him, he's not a Buddhist, and he said to me, I said, so do you think there's randomness or karma? He said, oh, well, I think there's some randomness and some karma. Science students are like this. And I said, well, what do you mean by randomness? He said, well, if I throw a ball at the wall, I don't know where it's going to land. I said, well, that's just ignorance. This is my brother, I can talk to him like that. And I said, I had to think about this big brother, he's older than me. I said, if you can predict the exact trajectory of the ball to the wall, the density of the air, the mass of the ball, the angle of my arm, I can predict exactly that it's going to land right there. Is that not true? It's true, isn't it? How do they get a spaceship to the moon? They just don't go, oh, well, there it is, we'll just fire it up. Wait till it comes past. I think we're ready. They predict it because things are predictable. That's karma, in a sense. So, yeah, you didn't talk to me much after that for a half an hour. So, we look at that. So, if you have cause and effect and randomness, what you have is randomness. You can't have half and half. So you have to have... So if you've got randomness doesn't work, cause and effect and randomness together doesn't work, because that's just randomness again. We have to have cause and effect, and we plan our lives on cause and effect in many ways. The difficult part is knowing the seed from lifetime to lifetime. That's the difficult part. We don't know whether that actually happens because we can't see it. However, if we really accept the Buddhist faith that it's all our fault, then we have to say that a previous incarnation of ourselves created the cause for the effect to happen. And then we can start to modify it. We can start to say, okay, if that's the cause. Now, for a karma to, this is the, again, Buddhist logic, you create the cause and the effect happens. What's the middle bit? What allows the effect to happen? Anyone know? Conditions. The conditions. You can't have a karma ripening unless there are the conditions. So if you want to be in a violent situation your whole life, you have to create the conditions. Join the mafia. Okay? Be in a situation where people are killing each other for territorial war or whatever, and you are going to be in a situation that you may die from a bullet much more effectively than if you're living a peaceful life as a monk. Now, that's not saying that monks don't get harmed in wars and things, but creating that situation, you're at much greater risk. I would love to have, you know, interview, well, not particularly personally, but I would love to have known an interview with some of the mafia bosses of the 1930s and 40s and asked them whether their lives were peaceful or they were always looking over their shoulders to see who was going to take their territory. They're creating the conditions to have a very fearful life, almost like a fish but with sharks after them. What's going on? That kind of situation. So if you want your mind to experience love and happiness, that's what you have to give out. They talk about prosperity. My teacher arrived in Australia in 1977 with $10 American dollars in his sock. And what they have in Melbourne, what he created in Melbourne, is a huge 10-acre property with a temple that sits 300 people, an enormous Buddha, twice the height of this room practically, and accommodation for 25 people. And it's extraordinary. He passed away in 2011, but he created this amazing monastery, a centre, with $10 in his shoe. And a monk from another centre came to him and he said, how did you do this? When all you had was $10, you weren't a businessman. How did you create this extraordinary paradise? And there's flowers and roses and lakes. It's the most gorgeous place to go. I've just been down there, actually. And he said, oh, it comes from the ocean. he always loved a leading kind of comment. It comes from the ocean. And they said, he said, the ocean? He said, yeah, the ocean of non-grasping. If you want to be wealthy, be generous. That's the karmic cause of wealth. And constantly gave his money away. constantly gave it away, and it constantly came back again. In fact, he sent myself and three other guys to India to give away $90,000, which was his whole bank account. Every penny of the bank account we gave away to monks and nuns and poor people in India. 6 million rupees. It's a lot of money. And so he proved that this cause and effect was, and we were able to see this. So I don't think it was just the fact that he was giving away. It was a lesson for all our students to realize that this is an actual thing that happened. The more you grasp, the less you have, or the less you feel you have. A greedy person is never ever satisfied. Again, a teaching of the Buddha. We know that for a fact. I want more. John Paul Getty Jr., who was one of the richest men in America, had a payphone. He was a billionaire, one of America's first billionaires. He had a payphone in his house because he didn't want people to make phone calls and that he'd have to pay for. I mean, that's tragic. And when at the end of his life, they asked him how much money he really wanted. And he said, just a little more. It's worth billions. In fact, they've actually done a scale of happiness, of wealth. So it goes up like this. When you have no food and water and whatever, you have great suffering. Then the moment you have subsistence, food and water and clothing and enough to eat, you have quite a degree of happiness. And in the Western world, it goes up to about 120,000. So you climb up, about 120 grand, you're quite happy. Then it starts to level out. Slight rise. When you get to a billion, it plummets. Because you've got to control it. You have a very difficult life. And nothing gives you great satisfaction. I've worked with one very wealthy lady who was absolutely furious. She flew in from London, first class, and she was absolutely furious because part of my other job is a shiatsu therapist, and she's not now, she lives in England, but at the time she wanted me to be present when she arrived so she could have her shiatsu and de-stress from her terrible first class flight from England. And she arrived, she was just furious. I said, what's up? She said, there was a baby crying in business class. And it kept me awake for a whole couple of hours. And she said, I'm furious. I'm writing to the airline and I want a refund. I would have loved to have been in first class with a baby crying in business class. That, I don't care how loud it cries. I'm in first class and I got a bed. So when you look at it, here was this woman with all this money going, that wasn't perfect. I paid all this money. It wasn't perfect. That's suffering. And it was genuine suffering. She was upset. It didn't work for her. So when we look at that, again, we go back to the teachings of the Buddha, or the teachings of my teacher, who said, just enough is perfect. If you can pay your bills without stress, if you have good food, clothing, your mind is peaceful, then perfect. More than that becomes a problem, balancing it. What investment will I do? Will I make more money? Will I get an extra percent here or an extra percent there? Then the worry comes in. And then the more money you have, the more difficulties you have. And it's not really about the money. It's about your attitude towards it. One of my friends, very wealthy Microsoft executive, who was living at the Buddhist Center, went to my teacher and said, I'm thinking of buying a Porsche. How do you feel about that? Geshe Lodin said, ah, oh, wonderful, German technology, fantastic, great cars. And then he looked at him and said, however, will you be worried about a scratch on it? Will you go out and polish it every day? Will you worried about rain? Will you be worried about it being stolen in the street where you park it? Then your pleasure becomes your torture. Your choice. Another example, friend of mine, buys himself, this is in the late 70s, bought himself a very expensive T $2,000 guitar. Musician. Now $2,500. Now $2,500 in the '70s worth about $10,000 or $15,000 now. That's a lot of money for an instrument for a guy that wasn't a professional. And I said to him after 6 months, so I said, how's that guitar going? And oh man, I had to sell it. I said, why? He said, it was torture. He said, I kept it under my bed. I said, I went home every night to make sure it wasn't stolen. He said, I never took it to a party because someone might spill beer in it. And he said, it was just a complete nightmare. He said, I couldn't stand it any longer. And he'd waited years to save up for this particular instrument. And it became his suffering. So he sold it to a friend of his, took it to parties, leaned it up against a wall. Couldn't worry about it in the slightest. It wasn't the guitar that was the problem, it was the attitude. And again, you look at that and you realise that Buddhist teachings keep coming through really clearly. What wonderful beat poet who used to spend 10 years in a Zen monastery, a guy called Gary, they asked him what his practice was. He said, oh, it's simple. When I walk down the street, I say to myself, what are you thinking now, mind? What are you thinking now, mind? Are you setting your mind up with tension? Are you setting it up with compassion, love? What's happening to my mind right now? To me, that's a really, really good practice of mindfulness. Just walking along. In fact, here's your practice tomorrow. Sometime tomorrow, while you're walking along, I hope you remember these words. What are you doing now, mind? Are you worrying about things you can't fix? Shantideva's words, 8th century. If I can fix it, why worry? If I can't fix it, why worry? Perfect. There's your stress management technique. And we often worry about things that we can't fix. So don't worry about them. Be totally irresponsible to the things you can't fix. There you go. You're off the hook. If you can fix it, fix it. I have a psychologist friend who wrote a book, Procrastinate Now. I'm going to read some more. Buddhists put faith in the reliability of the Buddha as a truly awakened spiritual friend. Faith, conviction and confidence in the three jewels. So he put the faith in this is a great line, the reliability of the Buddha. This is where you take the teachings of the Buddha and you go out and you apply them to your life. The reliability. Does this stuff work? By the way, do you know how many Buddhists there are in the world now? 1 billion. A billion Buddhists. It's a big family. 1/7 of the world's population of Buddhists. Hopefully following similar lines, but really, in a sense, just connecting with the teachings and then having faith in the three jewels makes you a Buddhist. Someone said to me, how do I become a Buddhist? Take the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha as your refuge. That's it. Don't I have to sign up? No, you don't have to sign up. Is there a ceremony? Not particularly. If you want, you can go and find one. Someone will give you a ceremony if you think it's important. But it's just actually having faith in the Buddha's reliability, in the teachers promoting that reliability, or at least explaining it, which is helpful. And those teachings, the truth, do they work? Okay, so I'm going to ask you a question now. Is there anything in terms of faith that you've had trouble with? Is there anything that you've struggled with where you've gone, I don't know about that? Maybe not now, but maybe when you first started with Buddhism. Things that you found a bit hard to deal with. Yeah?
Believing in things you can't prove.
Believing things will come true.
No, believing in things that you can't prove.
Experience. So give me an example of that.
I guess what you mentioned about past lives and so on.
You can't
really see it unless you've experienced it.
That's an interesting one, the past life stuff, and I mentioned that before. That's hard for some people. I know a lot of people from the outside go, well, why would I believe in that? For me, I totally believe in past lives. I have total faith in it. I have no proof whatsoever. Can't remember any. But I do have absolute faith that that's the case. However, that's a difficult one. The Dalai Lama gave an example of that, which again doesn't prove it, but it's kind of a way of just starting to look at it. If you recognise that you are conscious now, when I mean conscious, I mean aware, experiencing consciousness. We could say that's the case right now. We're aware of our existence. When we were a child, we had the understanding that we existed, didn't we? Had happiness and sadness, but we had a sense of being, existing. The Buddha said that one moment of consciousness creates the next, and there's been a continuum of that consciousness from childhood to now. And one moment before that we were conscious, and a moment before that. He said, why would consciousness begin with just your parents? If your consciousness is your parents' consciousness, why don't you experience it the same as them? This was the logic behind it. Now, again, it's not provable because it's an understanding. But to me, that gave me some understanding that one moment creates the next moment of awareness or consciousness. But I agree with you. It's not provable. And for some people, so as if that's part of a stumbling block in Buddhism, but all the rest is okay, then just put it aside. Just put it over there and go, yeah, we'll wait until that's cleared up. It may not be cleared up. That doesn't stop you acting out the other things that do work for you. And that's the thing I like about Buddhism. You don't have to go, oh, I believe the whole lot and I've signed up. It's not that kind of thing. It's like, okay, I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure how that fits together. I'll just put it there for the moment. Maybe I don't understand enlightenment. You know? Well, that's okay. But I do know that when I'm feeling harmonious in my life and peaceful, that is a great state to be in. And I know that when I meditate enough, and when you do a meditation retreat for a weekend or something, at the end of it, you look at your mind and you go, I feel really content. I feel really peaceful. So we're looking for happiness. I mean, that's an evident truth that the Buddha said, really self-evident. All beings want happiness. Beings never want suffering. That's a self-evident truth. All of us have the same experience. In every facet of our lives as human beings, we know that truth. And we look at animals. We look at a dog. A dog never wants harm and pain. It wants food and comfort and warmth. Wants happiness, doesn't want suffering. So that's a really self-evident truth. And again, that develops this strong belief that, okay, these Buddhist guys, they kind of know what they're talking about. That's true. So how do I develop? How do I get happiness and avoid suffering? And you find out the technology that works there. What are the things that create happiness? When I was saying in karma, when you have fertile ground, out of an agitated mind comes all the things we don't want. An agitated mind is kind of the fertile ground for negativity to arrive. When the mind's agitated, stuff happens. You're forgetful, you communicate badly, you do all the things you don't want in life, comes from an agitated mind. From a calm mind comes all the things you do need, which is love, compassion, wisdom, good business judgment, comes from a calm mind. I'll tell you a story about a guy I was teaching in to a engineering company. Any engineers here? Good. Engineering company called Trelleborg in Melbourne. And Trelleborg make capstans. You know what a capstan is? Does anyone know what a capstan is? Oh, come on, you lot. Okay, a capstan is a thing they wrap big ropes around to pull boats in with. You know those big things that turn? That's called a capstan. And they're about half the size of this room. And Trelleborg Industries makes these things and sells them to shipping ports all over the world. They've got complex electronics. And so I gave it to our lecture to the engineers about stress management and everything, and they kind of got it. And they said, yeah, but the guy you've got to speak to is our troubleshooter. I said, oh, yeah. They said, he's amazing. We fly him by jet all over the world when there's a problem. I thought, oh, this will be guy. This guy's probably got his hair standing on end. He's at the pointy end of stress. So I go and find him, and there's this guy, he's so chilled. I go, so what's your story? He said, oh, yeah. I said, you have a lot of stress. He said, oh, yeah. He said, I was in Brazil 2 weeks ago, and he said, a capstan had broken down. He said, I had to fix the electronics, and I couldn't work out how to fix it. I go, oh, yeah. I said, was that stressful? He said, yeah. He said, if I didn't fix it in 2 hours, he said, we were going to lose $10 million. I went, what? He said, well, the tanker wouldn't come in. It'd have to sit offshore, and $10 million would have been wasted. I went, whoa, that's pressure. Can you imagine? You got 2 hours to solve a problem, and there's $10 million sitting above your head. Wow. So, he said, what did you do? He said, oh, what I always do. He said, I go off to a corner and sit down by myself. And I said, what, solve the problem? He went, no, definitely not solve the problem. So I just empty my mind. So I just make my mind completely open and don't think about the problem. I said, what happens? He said, oh, then up comes the answer. And I go, I tried it. And he said, worked. I said, do you know what that's called? He said, no. I said, that's called meditation. He went, I've often wondered what that stuff was. What meditation was. He'd found the technology of meditation to solve really, really stressful problems. And he had no idea that that was what he was doing. Just calming his nervous system down and opening his mind to the possibilities. So you look at that and you go, this stuff works, you know. This really does work. And you've experienced it yourself when you've done meditation over, as I said, over a retreat or something. Come out of it at the end of it and you go, gee, everything's pretty okay, really. Doesn't matter what it's like. It's just okay. It's because we've changed. We cannot change the externals very much at all. We're quite powerless to change the externals. If it's raining, for a farmer it's joy, for a picnic maker it's a disaster. Truth is, it's just raining. No big deal. But we can turn it into a disaster or a success depending on our tension and our agitation. So looking at the truth of just meditation as a builder of faith in your practice is that stuff works. And now every company, pretty much every big company, certainly in the Western world and in fact pretty much across the world, do meditation and mindfulness. 30,000 employees of the ANZ Bank were put through a meditation course. Why? Because it improves sales. It sounds cynical, doesn't it? But calm, focused, happy people work really well. Tense, freaked out workers don't work well at all. So you start to see this ancient technology being used in a modern context. And when you see that, you go, yeah, wow, that's fantastic. And the Buddha said, look, take what is useful and use it. This is great. Take what's useful. And they now talk about, in business, compassion. Talk about being compassionate. And there's companies now that say to their employees, you can arrive at 8:30 and 9, but I want you to go home at 5:30. I met a company director who said, my employees are not allowed to work back and they're not allowed to take work home. And if they're honest employees and they work faithfully till 5:30 and they're not getting the job done, he said, we'll employ another person to help them. He said, because I want everyone in my company to be really happy and positive about their work. He said, I don't want them to be freaked out because then they're not going to work well. Anyway, I'm going to read some more. Where was that? Okay, so faith in the Theravada tradition is generally confidence based on first-hand understanding of a concept. So the first one is faith in the working of the law of karma. Now that's a faith that karma, cause and effect, works. Faith in the consequence of actions. Creating a negative action will not result in a positive result. Thieves get caught and end up in jail. Faith in the individual ownership of actions. As I said earlier, it's all our fault. Good news. Faith in the reality of the enlightenment of the Lord Buddha. Now again, that's a difficult one. Because if we're not enlightened, how do we know what enlightenment is? But when we look at the truths that have come out of that universal mind and we test them out, we can say, okay, yes, that's coming from a place that I didn't know about. Constantly, when I read Buddhist books, even after 35 years or so of practice, I still read stuff and I go, that's amazing, you know. That's really amazing. That's an incredible insight that I hadn't looked at before. One of my friends, and this is, they say that the more you understand, the more you see, the more you listen and read, and the more you understand. One of my friends said, he keeps reading my teacher's books. He's written 7 or 8 of them. And he said, he keeps changing the text. In other words, when he reads it, he sees more into it. He sees more truths coming out, even subtleties. And that unfolding then keeps you really enrolled in the understanding of what's going on, the understanding of your practice as a Buddhist. Okay, I'll read some more. Something I wanted to read. Okay, this is the Lotus Sutra. Has anyone heard of the Lotus Sutra? You probably have. Yep. One of the most famous Mahayana sutras, Lotus Sutra, also embraces the ideal of faith, but it links it to discernment. The Buddha tells his audience in the Lotus Sutra, if any living beings who seek after the Buddha way either see or hear this law flower, sutra, and after hearing it believe and discern, receive and keep it, you may know that they are near perfect enlightenment. The same sutra asserts that Dharma as a whole is difficult to grasp with mere words, and that ultimately only those bodhisattvas who believe with firm faith can penetrate its true nature. And the Buddha says, the law of Dharma is inexpressible. It is beyond the realm of terms. Among all the other living beings, none can apprehend it, except the bodhisattvas who are firm in the power of faith. So what this means is that we look towards the greater practitioners of the art of Buddhism and say, where are they coming from? What do I get from them? When you meet a great monk or a master or a nun who has real clarity. In fact, there's a nun that's coming out to Australia. Not a nun, sorry. She's a Austrian woman. She wasn't ordained. Who spent 25 years in retreat. And 10 of it in isolation. 10 years in total isolation. And they reckon that just being in her presence is really quite extraordinary. Just being around her is an experience. And that again is a sign of someone's level. Has anyone met great practitioners like that in their travels or come across a monk or a nun where they've gone? Yep. Yeah. I was head of security for the Dalai Lama for about 5 tours. And I saw his effect on the police, which was incredible. There was a situation, this is 1996, head of the special branch was, he had 15, these were the cops that talk into their sleeves and wires in their ears. And at the end of a tour, he was there for 10 days, and these guys were going to the airport. Tough, well-seasoned policemen, detectives, special branch. And I rang them up because I couldn't get to the airport, and I said, oh, how did that go, guys? And his second in charge was with him, and he said, oh, it was a complete disaster. I said, what do you mean it was a disaster? He said, We're standing there crying our eyes out, waving at the Dalai Lama, leaving. He said, very embarrassing. You know, and you see those effects. I've seen huge motorcycle cops with the Dalai Lama coming up and blessing them, and they're shaking like little leaves because of the power of his realization. I've seen journalists blown away by him. And why? Because of his practice. Not just because he's got a name, I mean his practice, his actual practice. And when you sit and talk to the Dalai Lama, it's the weirdest experience. It actually feels like you're the only two people in the universe. It's the most extraordinary experience I've ever had. And I've met many teachers, but it's like you and him. And his power of concentration is so powerful, nothing seems to exist. And it's not intimidating, it's just really unusual. And so when I meet people like that, yep, you had a question?
Can you remember one little thing that happened between you and Dalai Lama that impressed you until now? Can you remember it sometime when you lost or whatever it is?
Yeah, sorry, Sam.
If I got you right, sir, you said you have been the security guard?
Yes, yes.
For Dalai Lama?
Yeah, yeah.
You must interact with him for a while.
Yeah.
As a,
Yeah.
Is there one thing that happens during that employment that impressed you? Actual thing that happened? For example, he gave you a cup of tea, or you buy him a chocolate or something like that?
Okay, I'll tell you my direct experience. Okay, you're asking. Good on you. Okay. I haven't expressed this to you before. All right. So, this was in 1982, even before this. And I wasn't head of security then. I was just sitting up all night opposite his hotel room. And those were the days where there weren't security teams, there was just one policeman, and the rest of us were all volunteer. And so the Dalai Lama, in the morning, would walk past, and he had his own security people, Tibetans, around him. And as he walked past, interesting you asked this question, but anyway, I'll tell you. As he walked past, he'd wave, and we'd go, right? And he'd float past all the security people like this, and he'd be like, we wave at him as he go past. So it came about at New South Wales University at the Clancy Auditorium. Has anyone been there? It's a really good university, trust me. And he was doing a discourse at the Clancy Auditorium. And again, I was there as security, volunteer security. And it came time to be presented to him and just give him a scarf. And I'm thinking, oh, this would be cool. I'll go up and have a word with the Dalai Lama. So I have the scarf. I walk up to him and I give him the scarf and I look into his eyes, and all of a sudden, it was the most extraordinary experience. It was like, does anyone, you know, in the sci-fi movies where they go into hyperspace, you know, when everything goes zoom, right? Like, I think it's called warp drive. Warp drive. Okay, everyone knows warp drive here. And all of a sudden, I'm looking at him, and it's like my mind has gone through his eyes into the universe, and I can remember thinking, oh my goodness, his whole mind encompasses the entire universe. And I'm just, you know, I was going to say, thank you for coming, Dalai Lama. It's really good to see you, and we've really enjoyed your teachings, and it's been wonderful, and like... And I couldn't move. I was just absolutely in this state of complete blown outness, and I said to myself, this is a complete Buddha. His mind completely pervaded the entire universe. And I can't remember whether I was looking at stars or experience or anything. And the next thing I know, someone's going, I could have been there for an hour or 10 seconds. I have no idea. That was my experience. So for me, no doubt for me, that was a Buddha, a living Buddha. For anyone else, I got no idea. But for me, as my experience, that completely blew my socks off. Thank you for asking that question. I've never shared that with anyone here before, but that was how I had it. Still got a bit of time. Any other questions you'd like on that? Yeah, you got one?
We were talking about cause and effect previously.
Yeah. Cause and effect. Does everyone hear that? Yep.
So I had a discussion with a friend a while ago.
Yeah.
So we had this discussion about like choice in general. Because in Buddhism, we believe that we have the choice to change our lives around, right?
Yeah.
So it might sound a bit weird, but we came up with this thought experiment where two people having grown up in exactly the same environments, two identical people.
Yeah.
So if they were presented with a situation, would they respond equally, or would you have the choice to respond differently? Because in cause and effect.
Ah, beautiful. What a wonderful question. Okay, I love this. Yeah. Every moment you experience is a result of a previous cause. Does this make sense?
Yep.
Right. So all of a sudden, you're in the same environment, two people in the same environment. Do you have a choice of response, or is it directed to karma? Is it cause and effect that you have no choice? Well, I'll make one comment. My teacher would say, no choice due to the force of karma. However, at every moment you are experiencing, you have choice. So, let me give you an answer, a direct one. Okay, we'll use anger as a case. Someone comes to me and they're really angry. I would accept, as a Buddhist, that I had created the cause for that person to turn up as an angry person in my life. Because I'm the interface for that. At that moment, I have a choice. Right? At that moment. I can be angry back at them, can't I? Or I can be peaceful, or I can be whatever. So, I have a choice. Now, there's someone else standing beside me and there's someone angry at them too. They also have that choice. I didn't have a choice in the fact that I could stop that karma coming because it came, I didn't know it was there. But at that very moment, I have a choice of what to create next. So if I want to know, and this is the Buddhist teachings, if I want to know what I've been, have a look at who you are now. If I want to know what I'm going to be, have a look at what your mind is doing now. So at every interface of karma, you have a choice. If I am angry back at this person, I've just created an enemy to turn up in a future time to be angry back at me. If, however, I create peace and harmony at that point, and it's difficult, I'm not saying these are easy things, then what I'm creating is someone that will turn up in my life as a friend next time. So every interface of karma, this is why we need to be mindful, every interface of karma we have choice. We don't have the choice that the karma is happening in a sense, but we have a choice of how we deal with that interface. Does that make sense? Not quite?
So our choice is not a result of our experiences, our personality, our attitude.
Yes,
in the past.
That's
something
right.
We can control ourselves.
Yeah, that's right. So we're the sum total of that. If we've lived a very angry, resentful life, then my reaction to that person will be to punch him in the nose. And this I came across a martial artist. I might have told this story before. I don't know. Doesn't matter. I repeat myself. There was a martial artist I came across who was. Has anyone ever done Wing Chun here? Ah. Very wonderful martial art, very devastating, extraordinary. So he was a Wing, and I'm Tai Chi, and he's Wing Chun, and we were doing sticky hands, because I've never done sticky hands. And he said to me during this practice, he's an American guy, he said, oh, do you get in a lot of fights? And I went, no. He said, what, you never get in a fight? I went, no. He said, oh, I'm in fights all the time. He said, oh, just before I left New York, I got attacked by three guys and had to fight my way out, and he said, you know, I'm always training because I'm always getting in fights. And I'm thinking, that's a bit weird. How come I don't get in fights? Doesn't matter. I don't want to be in fights. Anyway, a bit later, someone said to me, his name was Bill. I don't know. I can't remember his name. They said, oh, I saw Bill come to a party. And I said, oh, yeah. He said, get this. He walks in the room like this. Who's going to attack me? Who have I got to fight? You know, some guy over there goes, oh, that guy wants a fight. He attacked me. I mean, it's pleadingly obvious that, as you say, the sum total of that guy's experience is the world is dangerous and you're going to be in a lot of fights. And that's his karmic choice. Now, hopefully, he hasn't been killed along the way because he's headed for a really dangerous life. Someone else that sees life as peaceful. In fact, there was a guy, non-Buddhist, who made this practice of going into the worst ghettos around the world and never being attacked. And he said it was to do with your attitude. To do with the way you... And I wouldn't recommend it. Could backfire badly because you've got some bad karma coming through. But, interestingly enough, it's what you put out. And the Dalai Lama was asked how he sees a stranger. He said, I don't see strangers. He said, I look at friends I haven't met yet. That shifts the perspective. Once we shift the perspective, in a funny kind of way, our karmas line up with that. If we create positivity in our mind, then what comes through is positivity, karmic results that are positive. If we create negativity, anger, hatred, miserliness, greed, fearfulness, that's how we're going to perceive the world. It's almost like, karmically, is that we have a projector shining out on the world, and then we look at it and go, oh, that's the way the world is. My projector shines out fearful, dangerous, evil people out there, and I go, oh, look at all those evil people out there, when in fact you're all very peaceful Buddhists. But it depends on the way that I'm creating that reality from my own thing. So you have to challenge your view when you're seeing things in a negative way. You have to challenge that view. You can challenge it even more. And there was Dzongtsa Khyentse Rinpoche, famous Lama who's around, said, if you want to see reality, this will rock your boat, if you want to see reality, just accept that everything you think and everything you see is wrong. That's pretty scary. He's a very controversial Lama. But what he's saying is, challenge the way you see things. Oh, it's terrible, life's a disaster, I'm never going to be any good. My teacher, again, Geshe Lodin, used to sit at the beginning of a talk. Oh, I have lost my boyfriend, I have lost my girlfriend, I have no money, I'm very unhappy, life is terrible, I have not got no prospects of getting a job. This is complete, and then you go, this is completely useless thinking. You throw out like bad socks. In other words, if you take the mind of agitation and negativity and you wear it like a mantle, that's how you're going to experience life. It doesn't mean, though, that you see life as rose-coloured glasses. You don't project, oh, everything's beautiful. Because it's not that way either. But if you are very present in your mind, if you're very present to what's going on with an open mind, without prejudice, Sogyal Rinpoche said, get rid of hope and fear. Oh, I hope it's going to be okay. I just put my money on that horse. I put all my money on the horse. I hope it wins. That doesn't work. And fearful, oh, life is terrible. I can't stand. Those two things, and I'm not talking about people in difficult circumstances, I do understand that, but I'm talking about us generally here who have a really pretty easy life. Don't project too much into hope and fear, but just be open to all the possibilities. And if the mind's as calm and clear as you can make it in that situation, then you have the fertile ground for acting accordingly in the right way. My friend, a Tai Chi teacher, once was threatened to be killed by this person. I said, what'd you do? He said, I just smiled at him. I said, what are you doing? He was a really angry guy. He said, what are you doing? And he said, the guy in the end just went, let it go. And he didn't have to fight him. He was a very experienced martial artist, but he didn't attack him or oppose him with anger and might, but he just said, well, what's happening here, and was really gentle with him, and the guy kind of calmed down and the situation was diffused. That's a true martial artist, how you absolutely rectify a situation without violence. With my security people, I had 84 in one of the tours. It was the biggest tour we did with the Dalai Lama, and these were bouncers all around Sydney and martial artists and third dan and fifth dans of all different disciplines. And I said to the team, if you have to touch one person, you have failed. If you have to grab somebody, you've failed. You have to control everyone without anger and without harming them. They all got it, good martial artists. And one situation happened where it was the end of a dissolution of the Dalai Lama, and they'd done a big sand mandala. And I'd got word down from the security, from the one of the security teams, that there was this lady that was really pretty off the air, a bit crazy. And to watch her, so I got two people to just watch her moving through the crowd. She'd been trying to get into security areas, and she was making a bit of a nuisance, a bit crazy. So I get this call on my comm set, you better come down here, this lady's really going off. She's eating the sand from the sand mandala. Oh, gosh. So I go down there and I said, look, I'm sorry, you can't do that. She starts swearing at me, and I mean really swearing at me. So as she's swearing at me, I start to walk with her. So for her to keep swearing at me, so she focused her anger on me. Don't you know this is a holy sand, I can eat it. I said, no, you really can't. And so she's walking with me as she's yelling at me. I keep her yelling at me. We get right close to the gates and I just nod to one of the other security guys and he steps in and she starts on him and he walks her out the gate. And then he walks back in and she's locked out. No violence occurred, no one had to touch her, grab her or anything. We just used, because we were in control of it. We didn't have to feel threatened or worried. Just that situation. Now, that was because I didn't know what to do. It wasn't any great geniusness, but once she started yelling at me, I thought, oh, maybe I'll just walk towards the exit. And it, by sheer good luck, it actually worked. And again, because I didn't actually have an agenda. Oh, I better put this woman in handcuffs or, you know, put cable ties around her and wrestle her to the ground. I just had to use, and because of my mandate that I wasn't going to touch anyone or grab them. And that was an option. If something went really nuts, we had that option. These guys were, you know, guys and women were great martial artists. But really, in the end, it was just being open to the situation with a view to keeping it peaceful. So once you have that agenda in your mind, then you can diffuse situations that are really can be quite tense. I'm not saying it works every time, but if you really have that in your mind, you don't create more agitation. If someone's being really angry with you, the last thing you want to do is be angry back at them because you just inflame the situation. Thich Nhat Hanh was asked when Osama bin Laden was part of the Twin Towers that knocked down, the great master, Vietnamese master Thich Nhat Hanh, was said, what would you say to Osama bin Laden? He said, I would ask him why he's so angry. What's the reason behind this? Not, you know, the anger coming back at him, but an openness. Why is this happening? And so, in a sense, if we're coming from the right position in our own mind, if we want happiness and peace, if we send that out to others, then you start to create harmony in your own world around you. You create that. And so those are some of the things. And we talked, as I said earlier, I start here and I end up somewhere else. But what I wanted to really talk about was this idea of faith and the trust that these teachings actually work. Now, I can only speak for myself. They absolutely work for me. Do I practice them well? No, not really. but I do the best I can. And that's as good as you can get. And the wonderful book called Start Where You Are. You know, I'm not a bodhisattva, I'm not a great practitioner, I'm not a great meditator, but I have started where I am. And that's the wonderful thing about Buddhist technology, I call it, is that you can take that bit where you are and use it. And then you find it works. It actually does work. And that's where you develop your faith. So it's, you have faith, you have experience, you develop more faith. You practice more, you have more experience, you develop more faith. And so, in a sense, even though we don't know the greatest mysteries, I don't know how an enlightened mind works, I've got no idea whatsoever. But in the experience I've had over 35 years, I have great faith in the Buddha Dharma. I absolutely believe in it. I believe in the understanding of dependent arising and emptiness. That really makes sense to me. I understand that great compassion is the way that you create harmony in the world. And Buddhism talks about compassion and wisdom. Those two wings to create enlightenment. So you have In the iconography of the Buddha, you have a lotus, which represents purity out of negativity and renunciation of negative states of mind and the cause of negative states of mind. You have a moon cushion, which represents ultimate compassion, the wish to become a Buddha so that you can enlighten all beings, and the wisdom that sees how reality functions. In those three things, you have the most extraordinary teachings, which is, for me, the essence of Buddhism, and where my faith is you know, determined. And everyone has to find their own. That's the good news. You can go out and explore. Okay. We've got 5 minutes left. If there's any... Yeah, you've got a question?
Just about faith in Buddhism.
Yeah.
Like, even within Buddhism itself, there are lots of traditions, things like that, and everything. So how do you know which one is the right one, things like that? Because obviously there are subtle differences in teachings.
Ah. How do you know...
Yeah.
What the different styles of Buddhism we're talking about, how do you know which is the right one? You go out and explore them all. You go out and have a look. Don't be limited. Find out what resonates with you and explore that. There's a wonderful poem of Dzogchen that says, take teachings everywhere. Digest in seclusion. And face, and I'm paraphrasing, it's not exactly the words because I can't remember exact words, but it says, like a deer, take teachings from everywhere, in seclusion digest, and then face the world like a lion, completely free of fear. So in other words, what you do is, if you're not sure, you go out and check it out. Just check it out. What resonates for me? Where do I feel most comfortable? What are the teachings? Is it Burmese, Theravada, Mahayana, Zen? Whatever, doesn't matter. Go out and check them all out. And then within a certain group, go out and check those teachings and say, actually, I feel like I fit here. Then you've got it. And don't worry about it until that point. So you go out and check everything. So that's really my answer to that. Just go and chew on all of it. See what it tastes like. Yep?
Would you say Buddhism is more of a philosophy?
Or a religion? I'm going to give you an answer, which is a Zen answer. When you come to a fork in the road, take it. So, Buddhism is both a faith, a religion, a philosophy. It kind of, it depends on what angle you're looking at. It's certainly a philosophy, but I have a little bit of a problem with the philosophy. And a philosophy is an intellectual understanding, whereas Buddhism is actually, you take a step into it. You know what I mean? It's not just a view from a philosophical view. It depends on the terminology, philosophy. But if it's a philosophical view, it's like, oh, that's very quaint, that's very interesting. But actually, the true Buddhist path is you take a step into the practices of that. Is it a religion? Yes, maybe not. Really hard to say, and I think you can only come from your own experience. For me, it's a way or a path. That's how I see it. Yes, it has philosophical understandings, absolutely, but it's not just that. You actually embark on a practice. It's not just an intellectual understanding. I guess what I can say is that knowledge is not wisdom. And what do you think the difference between knowledge and wisdom may be? No, it's not quite.
Money is not finance.
Wisdom is actually the practice of knowledge. Right? Knowledge is information. Okay, so let me explain. Data is not information. Information is not knowledge. Knowledge is not wisdom. Wisdom is the action of knowledge. So you can have someone that can quote you sutra, tons of them, all the information. But they're angry, miserly, and not very nice to be around. It's how you use the knowledge is where that's where the wisdom is. And that to me is really important. So wisdom is more important than knowledge. And wisdom comes out of experimenting with the knowledge over time. I once belonged to a group for a while that was called Wisdom Organization, and we explored the wisdom of different cultures. And what we realized was that the wisdom of different cultures came out of the experience of testing the knowledge in your own experience. So it came out over time. So we developed wisdom through trying this and finding out that didn't work, and then trying that and going, yeah, well, that worked. If I keep doing that, that's going to work. So that's where it changes from philosophy into action. Any more? You again. Come on.
What did Buddha say about money?
About money? Ah. Money is very useful.
That's what he said.
Nah, I have no idea what he said about money.
What did the Lama say about money?
Money, look, my teacher says money is very important. It can feed you, but your attachment to it can be the cause of suffering.
Attachment.
Yeah. So that's the difference. Be wealthy. Be really wealthy. I hope all of you become really wealthy, and then you can take that money and do really good things with it. Or you can do things like poor old Jamie Packer, who decides to build casinos with his billions. And I feel really sorry for him. Here's a guy with billions of dollars, and what's he want to do? Build a casino. That's really sad. Whereas you can become, all of you become billionaires, and think of the good that you can do with that money. Look what Bill Gates is doing now. He's actually giving billions away and working on many, many projects. Warren Buffett, you know. So yeah, become wealthy. It's really important. But if money is your prime object because you think that's going to make you happy, watch out. In fact, Kerry Packer and another guy who is not alive now because he committed suicide, called Rene Rivkin. Rene Rivkin said Kerry Packer and he used to sit in the Cosmopolitan at Double Bay and talk how miserable they were, and they were both, one was a billionaire and the other was a multi-millionaire, and he said we figured we were the two most miserable people in Sydney. Money doesn't make you happy, but lack of it can cause you problems as well. So yeah, get wealthy, do well in your jobs, and do really well in your jobs, and then use it usefully. You'll get a lot of joy out of it. There was a couple, they were doing a survey of people that had won the lottery. This is quite a few years ago. And people that had got 20 or 30 million in one hit. And generally, they had joy for 6 months and then kind of tapered off. Whereas one couple turned their 20 million into soup kitchens in Melbourne. And they got a lot of joy. They fed the poor. So it depends how you use it. All right. Well, I think we've done it tonight. Thank you very much for being present. Thank you for your input. I really enjoy coming all the time. So thank you very much for inviting me.